Hello? What's your name? Yeah, she's deaf. Just a sec. How do I say your name? Spell it for me. Lisa. Lisa today has arrived and she's just visiting from overseas, but she's completely deaf. So she can speak on the and through the phone with you. And so welcome, Lisa, and we just hope that you enjoy what you can of our service. We don't have signers or anything here, and the couple that deaf couple that are often here aren't here today. So another awesome reading, and it's amazing the way, if I can get my message up, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? It's amazing when we read through the scriptures, it doesn't matter how often we read them, Yah still speaks to us. And today I want to take my reading from Deuteronomy chapter 3 and verse 13. And I've given it a title which is called You Are Not Done Yet. I think I was speaking to me mainly. I've been fairly sick all through the week. But anyway, we'll see how we go. Can we have the first slide up, please? The rest of Gilead and all of Bashan, the kingdom of Og, I gave to the half tribe of Manasseh. The whole region of Argob, together with all of Bashan, form what is called the land of Rephaim. And in verse 18 to 20, it says, At that time I gave you this order. Yehovah, your Elohim, has given you this land to possess. But all of you are fit to fight must cross over, armed ahead of your brothers, the people of Israel. Your wives, your little ones, and your livestock, I know you have much livestock, will stay in your cities, which I have given you, until Yehovah allows your brothers to rest as he allowed you, and they too take possession of the land Yehovah, your Elohim, is giving them on the west side of the Yarden. At that point, you will return each man to his own land, which I have given you. And this is really important because the half tribe of Manasseh, they got their land before they had to go over the Yarden. But Yah says, I'm not done with you yet. You're going to help your brothers and you're going to fight for their land. Then you can go back and enjoy yours. And I want to illustrate this more succinctly, and I want to share with you the building of how church buildings were built during the 12th and 13th centuries. And would you believe the history of tennis? Now, I do like tennis. Throughout the 12th and 13th centuries in Europe, the religious people of the day would often build places for themselves to pray and to study. These were the Bible schools or Bible colleges of their day. Men, typically of wealthy families, would go to these monasteries and devote their time to the church. It was usually the second-born son of the family that was put into the church. Whether it was the Anglican Church or the Catholic Church, it was always the second-born son. The first-born son was the heir, so he stayed to look after the family property and learn how to do everything in the property. But the second-born son usually became the priest. Now, the architecture of these buildings in the 12th and 13th century was almost always the same. They set walkways covered by a sloped roof that went all the way round the central courtyard. and the courtyard provided a place where men could meet when they weren't inside the building to socialise or to read as they saw fit. Now, around this same time, there was a group of Muslims living in Libya, Morocco, and Spain called the Moors. These Moors brought to Europe a game that involved hitting a ball across a rope, and that was stretched between two posts. Players in the game would hit the ball using their hands to try and get it over the rope. The player on the other side of the rope would return the ball and so forth until the ball touched the group. Because it would sometimes hurt your hand hitting the ball over and over, players would then wrap their hands with strips of cloth called rucatoise, which gave us the modern word racket. Over time, the game was modified to local tastes and customs. For example, it was sometimes hard to determine whether the ball went over the rope or under the rope. So they simply, to prevent arguments, they replaced it with a net. As the game travelled east towards France, it began to pick up French names. Each player begins with the 0 point, using the French word "loof," which means egg, but is now pronounced, of course, as love. As each player scores a point, they keep track by referencing the clock and the hour marks on the hands. They had the 15, 30, 45. And before a player served the ball, he would shout to his opponent, "Get ready," or "Here it comes." And the French word for "here" is tenets, which is where we get the modern name of tennis. As the game became more popular across France, the monks found that the game was ideally suited to play inside the open courtyard at the centre of the monastery. That's why the game of tennis is played on a court. Lastly, the monks made one last change to the scoring of the game. The scoring used to be egg or oof, 15, 30, 45, and match. But the monks, being religious folks, preferred to use a good scriptural number. So they changed the 45 marker to 40 after the 40 days of Noah's flood, or 40 days of Moshe on Mount Sinai. And of course, Yeshua was in the wilderness 40 days after he was immersed. After all these changes, the monks in France finally settled on a game called tennis. They used balls, rackets, and nets and courts, and the score was kept as love, 15, 30, 40, and match, as it is today. The game became so wildly popular in France and much of Europe in the 13th and 14th centuries, since the monasteries all over Europe were filled with unmarried men, these monasteries soon became filled with men completely preoccupied with sport. Many letters were written to the Pope in Rome complaining about the foul language that filled the monasteries coming from the young men playing tennis all the time. What started to cause a problem for the church wasn't just the language, but the fact that the game distracted the young men from their main tasks of prayer and study. In fact, the game was so popular that many monasteries in Europe that were commissioned by the church were never, ever completed. The men would come into town, level the ground, lay out the monastery, and even install the posts for the courtyard, but then immediately abandon their work and just begin playing tennis in the courtyard of the unfinished monastery. These men were all assigned a task: to build a monastery where men could pray and study the word of Yehovah. Instead, they left the work they were assigned unfinished. So this brings me to the leisure of Menashe. In the book of Devarim, chapter 3, there's a story of the tribe of Manasseh before Israel entered the promised land. The B'nai Israel, that is the children of Israel, were on the east side of the Yarden River when the king of Og came out to attack them. But the B'nai Israel defeated them. Can we go to the next slide, please? In Deuteronomy 3, verses 3 and 4, it says, "So Yehovah Elohim also handed over to us Og, the king of Bashan, with all his people, and we defeated him until he had no one left. At that time we captured all his cities. There was not one city of theirs we didn't capture. There were 60 cities, all in the region of Argov, the kingdom of Og in Bashan." This land of the kingdom of Og received a lot of rainfall. It had plenty of pastures and was perfect for raising cattle. It seemed like such a waste to let this piece of land go to their enemies. In fact, Yekezkel or Ezekiel used the livestock of Bashan as a type of a very strong and hearty cattle or livestock. In the slide 4, goes on with Ezekiel, please, or Yekezkel 38:9-18. Ezekiel says, "You will eat the flesh of heroes and drink the blood of the earth's princes. Rams, lambs, goats and bulls, fattened in Bashan, all of them." The scriptures also tell us the oak trees that grow in Bashan were the strongest and the best trees for making boat oars. The cattle of Bashan are very big and strong and tasty. It's a rich, desirable land with only one problem. It was on the wrong side of the river for the promised land. Nevertheless, Moshe gave the land of Og to the tribe of Manasseh. Let me go to the next slide. In verse 13 of Devarim 3, "The rest of Gilead and all Bashan, the kingdom of Og, I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh. The whole region of Argov, together with all of Bashan, form what is called the land of Rephaim." Manasseh received an allocation of land on both sides of the river. He had some on the eastern side of the Yarden and some on the western side. So the tribe of Manasseh was split into two halves. Half the tribe was outside the promised land, half the tribe was inside. So in that respect, Manasseh actually received a double portion of land because they were considered the firstborn. Can we go to the next slide, please? In Devarim 21:17, and I know we haven't got there yet, but it says, "No, he must acknowledge as firstborn the son of the unloved wife by giving him a double portion of everything he owns. For he is the first fruits of his manhood, and the rights of the firstborn is his." And in Bereshit, or 48 verses 20 to 22, it says, "Then he added this blessing to them on that day. Israel will speak of you in their own blessings by saying, may Yehovah make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. Israel then said to Yosef, you see that I am dying, but Yehovah will be with you and will bring you back to the land of your ancestors. Moreover, I am giving to you Shechem, that is the shoulder, ridge, share, city of Shechem, more than to your brothers. I captured it from the Emory with my sword and bow." The firstborn gets a double portion of the inheritance. And that's the firstborn male. There can be four daughters and then the male, but the four daughters get nothing. It's the male that gets that double, the four girls get an inheritance, but the male gets the double portion. And that's in place to this very day, according to Jewish tradition. But it is the male that inherits, and Israel intentionally goes out of order and makes the Joseph's younger son, Menashe, receive the double portion when he crossed his hands over. And that was fulfilling the prophecy and the will of Israel towards Menashe. And furthermore, Menashe will be split, the half tribe living in the promised land, the other tribe living outside the promised land. But remember, at this point of history, the B'nai Israel still haven't captured the promised land. They're technically still wandering in the wilderness without a home. Menashe has a place, but the rest of the 11 tribes and the other half tribe still don't have anything. It would have been easy for Menashe to give up at that point and take it easy for the rest of his life. They could have simply said to their brethren, thanks for helping us get this far. Good luck storming Jericho. They could have been busy raising cattle and oak trees and on their new land. But Yah was not done yet. Moshe had to say to Menashe in Devarim 3 and 18 to 20, At that time I gave you this order, Yehovah your Elohim has given you this land to possess. But all of you who are fit to fight must cross over, armed ahead of your brothers. They had to go first, not behind. Ahead of your brothers, the people of Israel. Your wives, your little ones, your livestock. I know you have much livestock. Will stay in your cities, which I have given you, until Yehovah allows your brothers to rest as he has allowed you. And they too take possession of the land Yehovah your Elohim is giving them on the west side of the Yarden. At that point, you will return each man to his own possession, which I have given you. Moshe actually made it clear to Menashe that he was not done yet. He still had more work to do. There's still a promised land to capture. You're not allowed to stop here and get on with your life. You're not allowed to sit back and raise your cattle while your brothers spill their blood on the battlefield. You need to get everyone who can carry a sword and get ready for the battles that have yet to be waged. I want to give one more illustration where Yehovah is not done with you yet. And I'm probably speaking of myself, as I said, because at 75, going on 76 years of age, people are usually retired at my age. But I know that Abba has more for me and Malachi, for that matter, to do. So I want to look at the story of Eliyahu. And I know I've spoken on this before, but it's very important because it ties in with the readings that we did today. In Malachim Aleph and chapter 18, there's a story of Eliyahu and the 450 prophets of Baal. And I know I've covered this, I said that, but I left it. I think it's really important that we revisit it. Eliyahu challenges the prophets to see which group can get their God to answer with fire from heaven. Baal has a storm god. Baal was a storm god and was often depicted in idols with a lightning bolt in his hand. As the god of thunder and lightning, one would think it would be easy for him to call down fire onto his altar. But Eliyahu had two bulls, one for Baal and one for Yehovah. The prophets of Baal went first and spent all day praying and chanting to their God and yelling out, Baal, hear us. And all the while, Eliyahu taunts them. Can we go to the next slide? In 1 Kings 18, 27 to 29. Around noon, Eliyahu began ridiculing them, Shout louder. After all, he is a god, isn't he? Maybe he's daydreaming, or he's on the potty, or he's away on a trip. Maybe he's asleep and you have to wake him up. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and knives, as was their custom, until blood gushed out all over them. By now it was afternoon, and they went on ranting and raving until it was time for the evening offering. But no voice came. No one answered. No one paid attention. So after the prophets of Baal were exhausted from their rituals, they finally gave up without receiving an answer from their God. And that's when Eliyahu steps up for his turn. Eliyahu has the people clean off the old altar. Then he had them dig a trench around the altar. Then he had them bring in 12 barrels of water and fill a trench. Now, I want you to keep in mind that 12 barrels of water is an awful lot of water for a place that's in drought. And they were in drought at the time. So the water was actually a miracle. After that, Eliyahu says a simple prayer. And I think this is the important part of the whole message. Yehovah wants our prayers to be simple. He says often, I don't want a lot going on and on and on. Nobody says you've got to pray in tongues for 2 hours and then you can start speaking to me. Be succinct. Be short and firm, and be precise for what you want. Because if you're not precise, you won't get the answer that you're looking for. So when it was time... So where was I? So we get Malachi Aleph, please, 18:36 to 37. So then it came time for offering of the evening offering. Eliyahu the prophet approached and said, Yehovah Elohim of Abraham, Yitzhak and Israel, let it be known today that you are Elohei in Israel, that I am your servant, that I have done all these things at your word. Hear me, Yehovah, hear me so that this people may know that you, Yehovah Elohim, and that you are turning their hearts back to you. That was simple. Didn't have a lot of words. He wasn't begging and pleading and going on and on and on. It was a simple prayer, wanting the hearts of the people to turn back to him. He was precise in what he wanted. Don't bless them. Don't do this. Don't do that. Just bring their hearts back to me. It's a simple prayer that asks God to let the people know that he is Yehovah and Eliyahu is his prophet. He doesn't ask for fire. He doesn't ask the musicians and the singers to come up and lead the congregation in some upbeat song to stir up the Ruach HaKodesh. He doesn't need a building program or a laser light show. All Eliyahu asks is that Yehovah would show the people the evidence that Eliyahu is acting on his behalf. And then in the next verse we read, then fire of Yehovah fell. It consumed the burnt offering, the wood, the stones, and the dust, and it licked up the water in the trench. Yehovah answered Eliyahu's prayer in the most dramatic possible way. He brought fire down from heaven that consumed the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, in the altar itself, and even the water that was in the trench around it. Eliyahu asked Yehovah for a sign, and the place exploded, literally. It would be easy to assume that this is the height of Eliyahu's ministerial career. It would be easy to assume that Eliyahu did the job that he was put on earth to do, to create the greatest pyrotechnic show that any church could have ever had. Eliyahu could understandably retire from the ministry at this point, because he would have been retiring on a high. But Yehovah has something more in store for Eliyahu. He was not done with him yet. Although Eliyahu to me was in a depressive, woeful state, in the next chapter, Yah sends an angel to feed Eliyahu some food. And the angel tells Eliyahu to walk for 40 days until he reaches Mount Horeb. Now we know where Mount Horeb is, where Moshe was the last place and where he died. And Eliyahu gets to Horeb and lies down in a cave where Yehovah asks him a strange question. In 1 Kings 19 and verse 9. There he went into a cave and spent the night. Then the word of Yehovah came to him and said to him, "What are you doing here, Eliyahu?" "Excuse me, Yah? What a silly question. You told me to come here." And he says, "What are you doing here?" Eliyahu tries to tell him he's been working for him, but now he's the only one left. No one is listening to him. There's no one left who will listen to me. You need to find someone else. But Yehovah answers Eliyahu, "You're not done yet." So he has Eliyahu go outside so he can have an object lesson. We go to 1 Kings or Malachim Aleph 1:19-11-12. He says, "Go outside and stand on the mountain before Yehovah." And right then and there Yehovah went past. A mighty blast of wind tore the mountain apart and broke the rocks in pieces before Yehovah. But Yehovah was not in the wind. After the wind came an earthquake. But Yehovah was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, fire broke out. But Yehovah was not in the fire. And after the fire came a quiet, subdued voice. Yehovah wasn't in the fire. Remember that Yah had already answered Eliyahu by fire. And that was the defining miracle of Eliyahu's ministry up at that point. Even today, if you ask someone what they know about Eliyahu, you'll probably get an answer like, "Well, he's the guy who Yehovah answered with fire." And yet, just after he answered him with fire, he takes him into the wilderness and says, "I'm not in the fire. You expect me to answer you with wind, just like I was in the wind that moved upon the waters at creation? But I'm not in the wind. You expect me to answer you with breaking rocks, like I did when I brought down the walls of Jericho? But I'm not in the broken rocks. You expect me to be the fire that came down from heaven and burned up the sacrifice in front of the prophets of Baal? But I don't speak to you with fire. You expect me to come into your life like a whirlwind every time you have a problem." How many of us do that? You think that if I'm not making wives from the sides of men or smashing cities into pieces or burning up stone altars with lightning that I've forgotten you. I speak to you with a still, small voice. I speak to you and you speak to others. I tell you, Eliyahu, what to do, and you make sure it gets done. For the second time in this exchange, Yehovah asks Eliyahu, "What are you doing here, Eliyahu? Why are you here in Horeb? Do you think that just because you called fire from heaven that your job is done? You're not done with yet, Eliyahu." After that, Eliyahu's role changes. He goes on to anoint two kings. He trains Elisha as his replacement. He gets carried away in a chariot of fire and a whirlwind. Eliyahu thought he was finished with, and the work of Yehovah had set for him. But little did he know what was in store in the future. Let me finish with this. You may be here today, listening online or in the room, and feel that Yehovah is done with you. He wants you to know that you are not done with yet. He still has plenty of harvest out in the field, or maybe you feel like you haven't had much spark lately. There's been no fire falling from heaven on your life lately. Maybe there's been too much fire on somebody's life lately. Maybe you feel it since there are no walls falling, then Yah must not be working in your life anymore. To you, Yehovah says, I'm not in the fire, I'm not in the rocks, nor am I in the wind. I am that still small voice inside you, and I need you to know and make sure that my will gets done. What are you doing here? I believe as long as we have breath inside of us, Abba is not finished with us yet. He still has more for us to do. How and what, I do not know. What I do know is that we have to stay close to his word and listen to his voice. He will direct our path. That is his promise. And it doesn't matter what we're going through, and everyone's going through stuff at the moment. It doesn't matter what we're going through. Listen for his voice. Trust him. As he told the people, the Israelim, the children of Bnei Israel, before they went into the promised land, I am going ahead of you. He put Menashe that were in Bashan to go first, to let them know like they know that they would be returning, that no one would be hurt, that he was working on their behalf. Whatever is going on in your life at the moment, let go. Let go of the worries, let go of the fears, let go of the hurts, and know that Yehovah is not done with you yet. He is in control, and he's going to turn whatever it is around that you're going through. And he's going to give you fullness of life in every degree that you can ever imagine, because he is the one who directs our paths. Let us now go to the remembrance service.